I'm at MIT. We're in the computer science and AI lab. We did merge, in case you didn't hear about that. We moved into our new Gehry building. So it's interesting to compare the Gehry building that we have, which is poked fun of in Doonesbury, if you haven't been following that. It's a joke about using it as a sobriety test, where if it looks okay, then you can. Doonesbury is interesting now for MIT people, because Alex goes to Doonesbury. Anyway, so we're, this is sort of similar field with plywood all over the place.
Ours cost $600,000 to build.
Hey, I'm sure we could negotiate like you could, I guess, right? Yeah, ours started off being $100 million, and went up going $300 million. It was really over budget. So the timing is also interesting for this event. So it was 30 years ago, almost to the month, that Diffie and Hellman published their paper on public key cryptography, New Directions in Cryptography, which introduced the idea of public key cryptography and got me interested in cryptography. And our note on ours, the paper on RSA, got some convergence of number theory and cryptography going, I guess, a little stronger. So it's an interesting time for that. There will be an event happening at the end of the month, I guess, at the Computer Museum, celebrating the invention of the public key cryptography concept. So again, thanks for inviting me here. This workshop is about open problems, is my understanding, as much as anything else. And so this will be a talk proposing an open problem, trying to get you excited about one particular open problem. Groups with infeasible inverses, and sort of motivate that and give you some context and some related problems. So it may actually be a short talk, because I don't have results to talk about. I'm just trying to say this is an interesting problem. So it may end a little quicker than the scheduled hour, but so be it. So I'll talk a little bit about controlled algebras, which is a term I've made up here. It's sort of a research program for generating research problems. And then some examples of that and related problems. So trapdoor discrete logarithm groups. Talk a little bit about related notions of black box groups and pseudo-free groups. And then the main course is groups with infeasible inverses, which is the open problem that I'd like to see somebody solve. I'm really more of a computer science and a scientist than a mathematician, so maybe somebody here can dive into this and solve that. It could be a pretty problem to solve. And then some related notions, transitive signatures, trapdoor pairings, and so on, too. Just setting some of the context and rounding it up. But that's the main outline and topic. So an algebraic structure, as we teach our undergraduates, you've got some sets and some operations defined on them, some mappings between them, maybe zero array, one array, whatever, binary. And so that's a mathematical object. And we can talk about the mathematical properties of this object, and the mathematical properties of the operations, et cetera. And the instantiation is a computational object. So if you're a computer scientist, you want to have some realization of that mathematical object as a computational object. You've got representations of each set, or each element of the set as maybe a canonical representation or multiple representations. And each operation has some associated computational procedure. So it'll be a subroutine that you write, or a Java code you give, or whatever. So these are different levels of abstraction. And we're doing mathematics, we think about this. When we're doing computer science, we think about this. And when we're doing cryptography, we're assuming the adversary is given something that looks like this. They're not given typically the mathematical object. They're given a computational object. And they have to frame their task as dealing with that computational object. So when you actually instantiate the mathematical object then as a computational object, you may have choices in that instantiation. And so this notion of a control, that's a term I made up, maybe there's a better term in the literature somewhere, but controlled algebra is an instantiation of that mathematical object as a computational object, where each operation that you might conceivably do in this algebra is controlled as to whether it's, first of all, feasible, that is, you give a public algorithm which says how to do it, or infeasible, you have reason to believe, either based on computational assumptions or reduction somehow, that nobody can do it, or trapdoor, in the sense that there's trapdoor information that allows some people, some parties to do some of that operation and not others. Well, this is not a surprising structure here, but you know, it shows you that really we have, when we think about a mathematical object, reducing it down to computational, means we have the freedom to choose whether individual operations are going to be feasible, infeasible, or trapdoor. And so we've got a ternary switch we can throw at each one and say, well, let's try this, let's try that. Let's get these different computational objects and see how they, see if we can realize them, and then look for applications. So the high-level research program is this, which controlled algebras can we make? We can take various mathematical structures and say, let's try flipping these switches different ways and see if we can realize those things. So this is sort of a research program starting from the mathematical abstractions and saying, what can we build, rather than starting from the applications. We're not starting with fighting spam or building digital signatures or something like that. We're not starting with the application. We're just starting with the mathematics here and trying to see what can we build. So if you look at groups, you know, if you look at the mathematical abstraction of a group, then we have lots of operations that we can flip this ternary switch on. We can, we've got the identity operation. I can imagine you could have a group representation where it's infeasible to come up with an identity operation. Well, that seems a little unlikely unless you've got some other things impossible too, but that's one of them you can try to control. You've got an operation that produces a generator or generators for the group. And so producing the generators may be something you could make infeasible or you know, and something, again, it's going to be relationships between these. So producing a set of generators may be controlled. Producing a random sample, or being able to sample from the group. You may be able to sample an individual element at random or computationally indistinguishably from random. Maybe you want to be able to sample with pairs so that you can sample both NA and an A inverse at the same time. So there might be several flavors of the sampling operation that you would want to control. Who can do that? Are those available? And again, some of these can be produced from other ones. If you can produce generators, you may be able to sample using those and a random replacement algorithm. You've got, of course, the group operation, which typically is uncontrolled or public and feasible. Inversion is the one that I'm focusing on here. Given an element, being able to compute its inverse. So you can ask the question, can we control that operation? Can we produce a representation of a group so that computing multiplicative inverses is maybe infeasible or feasible only with trapdoor information? That's really the main question of this talk. And quality testing, you may have an operation of being able to test two elements as to whether they represent have the same representation. When can we control that independently of the others? And we may or may not have a canonical representation, an operation that produces canonical representation of the element, which of course would yield in a quality test. And we've got a lot of other operations associated with groups that we use all the time in cryptography. Being able to take discrete logarithm, for example, being able to take roots, do the decision Diffie-Hellman or computational Diffie-Hellman, being able to hash into the group. These are all operations that we use when we use a group in practice. So each of these, you can imagine, we've got 24 different operations. So we've got 2 to the 24th different possible research programs here to look at, and trying to figure out which of these makes like string theory. Which sound like string theory? Yeah, maybe. which universe do you want to live in? Right, so, some of these may be interesting mathematically and in terms of applications and so on too. So which of these makes sense? Which can we implement? This is supposed to be multidisciplinary, right? So this is the slide. This is how you get funding for this research program. This is biologically inspired mathematical research. One of the wonderful things about DNA is how the expression of a gene is really separate from the control of the gene, right? And so you've got a part of the genome that expresses what protein is made, what the semantics of that gene are, and then the control for that is separate. So there are places on the DNA that are next to the gene. There's the promoters and various kinds of regulatory things that are next to it. And those are separate, and they evolve separately. You can have mutations in what protein is made, you can have mutations in the control. It's not that the control attaches to that part of the gene that makes the protein, it attaches to something next to it. And so you have a separate control mechanism from the protein itself. Right? So at a very metaphysical level, that the research program I'm talking about has the same flavor. Right? We separate the notion of control from the separation of what's done. You can have a trapdoor attached to an operation. So these are the operations. That's whatever, that's metaphysics. So as a first example of such a notion, trapdoor discrete log groups, there's a nice paper by Denton Galbraith that I'll mention several times. Some related examples. They seem to be buying into this kind of a research program too. So they suggest the notion of a trapdoor discrete log group. So you've got a group which has got some generator G. It's public. It's a cyclic group. So it generates a group by, and the operation is feasible for everybody. So it's standard, except we want a trapdoor in the discrete log operation. We'd like somebody to be able to compute trapdoors in this group. So this has applications. Okay? You can imagine doing things with such a group. You can do a key agreement. You publish the description of the group. Somebody can use the public key. They can encrypt, you know, raise G to the X, and basically send you X. You've got the trapdoor. You can compute X. So you can use that as a public key kind of mechanism for key agreement and encryption. Some way you can get out of that. So there's a controlled algebra, a controlled group, if you will. We sort of know how to do things close to this, but not exactly this. Right? This I don't know how to do this precisely. Denton and Galbraith have some proposals, as you'll see. So this is I consider this an open problem to be able to construct practical trapdoor discrete logarithm groups where we have the discrete logarithm operator controlled under a trapdoor. Now things are public. So you can do products, you can do inverses, etc. You've got generators. But the discrete log is under control. So the Pierre is sort of close. Right? In the Pierre cryptosystem, you've got essentially a discrete log operation to decrypt, but it's you've got the blinding of the, it's not just G to the M, it's G to the M times some blinding factor. So that's sort of close, but it's not quite the same. In terms of applications, you can do almost all the applications with Pierre that you'd want this for. But as a research program trying to figure out what you can build, you know, there's this. And then there's the proposal by Denton Galbraith for a pairing-based approach. And they use index calculus, and they build up the tables once to be able to do that, and then that becomes your trapdoor. I think it's somewhat impractical. So there's an example of this research program. Can you build such an object? Nice, lovely, crisp question.
How large are the tables? Or is it that they succeed to do it, but it's really impractical, or is it that they
sort of give a light description, and I think the tables look too large for practical use to me. So there's, well, there's, because it was too large, they're good. So in terms of related notions, so there's the notion of a black box group, which we should probably try to relate to what we're talking about here, just for clarity, and also the next slides on pseudo-free groups. So the notion of a black box group is prevalent in the field too. And what is that? So that's a representation, basically, of the mathematical object. We're assuming that the computational representation and the mathematical representation are the same. Basically, so the adversary and everybody else has access to the standard operations. So usually they don't talk about controlling all the operations in the way that I'm talking about, but just the standard operations of multiplication in the group, say, are all available in a black box way, and nothing else. So there is that notion of controlling other things. So it's just the mathematical object. And so there's some attempt to produce black box groups for particular groups. So Frey and Galbraith, for example, have papers talking about elliptic curve groups and trying to make it the case that the only thing somebody dealing with the computational representation that's given to them can do is work with the given primitives in a black box way, that there's no other structure that you might use the elliptic curve, say, that you could use. The elliptic curve is hidden, or disguised is the term they use, so that you can't see anything else. You've really just given the group in an abstract sense. So that the goal there is to take a given mathematical group and present it in a way that it really is available only in black box form. So you take a particular group and you give the standard operations in black box form, and other things can't be done on that. By contrast, the notion of a pseudo-free group is somewhat different. So there, we're talking about finite computational representation of groups, but these are groups which, to all intents and purposes, are computationally indistinguishable from the free group. So if you're dealing with a set of elements which are drawn by a sampling procedure, you won't be able to find any non-trivial relationship between them. You won't be able to produce any equations which don't have solutions in the free group, which do have solutions in the computational instantiation. There's no way computationally to distinguish the group you're given in terms of its computational interface from a free group. It just won't be able to find orders of elements. You won't be able to take square roots or anything else. So this is the definition of a pseudo-free group. So it's not trying to hide the representation of a group, which really is representing that group. It's really showing that particular groups are indistinguishable from the free group. And Daniela was here somewhere. I was able to give an excellent proof that showed that the Zn star is pseudo-free, given a strong RSA. So that's a somewhat related notion, but a little bit different. So that's just showing that two groups are indistinguishable. So groups with infeasible inverses. So this is the proposed problem. We'll talk a little bit about that. But as I said, I don't have results on this much, and it won't be a long talk. So we'd like a group representation. This is the proposal for it. I'd like to see somebody find one of these. So that the group operation should be easy, but finding inverses should be hard. So we're going to control this. And say this should be infeasible, or maybe have a trapdoor if we want a trapdoor group with infeasible inverses. So is there some way that you can present a representation, a computational representation of a group, so that you can do things like sample elements, and maybe sample elements with their pairs, or there seem to be some interesting differences there. So you can sample elements, you can do the group operation, you can compute products, but nobody can compute inverses. It's computationally infeasible to compute inverses, given the representation. No reason in principle why you shouldn't be able to do that. So you somehow create a group representation that supports products, but doesn't support computing inverses. I don't know any reason why that shouldn't be doable.
So the order is secret.
The order has to be secret, yes. That's the first observation, right? That's all. So Susan Hohenberger looked at this in her master's thesis, which is available on the web. You can find it at our just Google her. And David Molnar and Vinod Vaikuntharathan have also been looking at this. So I'd like to see that. There are some applications of this. Once you have a new kind of computational object, you can say, well, what can I do with it? So key agreement is turns out to be easy. Susan mentioned this in her thesis, and Robbie, and it's based on a protocol by Robbie and Sherman. So Alice, we're sort of assuming we've got sampling, so Alice can draw random elements from the group. She's got X and Y, very much like the Diffie-Hellman key agreement. So Alice sends Bob the product X, Y, in the group, and Y. Bob draws a random element Z and sends Alice the product Y times Z. So you can compose Y times Z and send that back. And then it's a group, it's associative, so both Alice and Bob can compute X, Y, Z. Alice has got Y, Z. She's kept X around. She multiplies that front. Bob has the symmetric thing. So we get key agreement. And that, as it turns out, is secure, given the assumptions we've got. So let's prove that, because this proof is easy. So that's the key agreement protocol. So let's assume we've got an adversary who can figure out the agreed upon key, K, X, Y, Z, from what she's heard, X, Y, Y, and Y, Z. So let's argue that Eve can then invert randomly chosen elements. Well, suppose you had such an Eve. What's the proof? It's easy. So you choose A at random, and then you give A a triple that she would be hearing. So x, y, we'll call it, let that be defined as a to the I. Y will be a to the j. Y, z is a to the k. So we've picked I, j, and k at random, subject to the constraint that I minus j plus k is equal to minus 1. And so we just pick three integers and satisfy that condition. Give E a to the I, a to the j, and a to the k. And then clearly, if you look at what's going on, the key is just a to the I minus j plus k, because we're multiplying these two and subtracting out the j. And that's A inverse. And so that's a simple proof that if you can guess the key, then you can invert.
Does it only work for cyclic groups?
So.
Because otherwise, powers of A are not random elements. If it's not a cyclic group. I mean, if the group is not cyclic,
yep.
The way you are taking your elements, they are no longer random.
Oh, I see. So these are, well, this A is random.
Yes.
So, and then X, Y, Y, and Z.
If you want the triple to be random.
Yeah.
I think it'd mean arbitrary when you say random.
Pardon?
It mean arbitrary when you say random.
Yeah.
Why do you need a group? One rate would be sufficient for some applications. For the application, you don't need the inverse state.
That's right.
Would do it.
Yeah. That's correct. So there are other ways of solving this application, of course. Yes. Yeah. This is key agreement is this solving this in different ways. I mean, it'd be nice for each such controlled algebra to find something it does uniquely that we can't do otherwise. We already have to do so many things in cryptography that we maybe have a hard time finding new applications. So this mission, we want to solve otherwise. So that's a good comment you made too about the simplicity of the. So there's a slight difference there.
I mean, it shouldn't be necessarily a random element. It should be a random product, right?
Yeah, like it's a random product.
If it's a group of prime order, it will all work.
So the argument holds for cyclic groups. And there's no reason to believe that you can't build cyclic groups that have this problem. But XY is a random product. YZ is a random product. So it looks like a triple of random elements. So, good, thanks. So there's a related notion which is also in the literature, and part of my goal here is just to survey what else is around here. Strongly associative one-way functions. So this is introduced by Robbie and Sherman. So you can have a binary operation on a set S such that it's easy to compute the binary operation. It's hard to invert and have it for either or both arguments. So given x composed of y and y, it's hard to come up with an x or any x prime that gives you the same value. F of x prime y is f of x y. So you can't invert to the left argument. You can also have it not inverting to the right argument. So it's one way. So there's a proof in the literature that these strongly associative, I mean, you also want the associativity. But these strongly associative one-way functions and one-way functions are reducible to each other on non-structured domains. But the proofs are highly unsatisfactory from a cryptographic viewpoint. There's a lot of, the worst case, it's a worst case proof, it's not average case, and the constructions are actually terrible for cryptography. But if you're dealing with groups, if you have a function on a group, these notions are really the same. In being able to invert is you have an associative operation. So. It's another source of ideas about how you might think about these things. If you're going to go think about this open problem, you might go look at their constructions. So you can also say, well, let's make it a trapdoor operation. Let's try to build a group with trapdoor inverses. And I'm not sure this is the best notation, TGIF. Trapdoor groups with infeasible inverses. It really should be groups with trapdoor inverses or something like that, GTIs maybe, but whatever. This is the notation that Susan used. So it's a group with infeasible inverses, except some trapdoor information exists that allows the computation of inverses. So the group order is obviously trapdoor information that allows you to compute inverses. So these notions are really pretty close. If you've got a finite group, there's always going to be this trapdoor information. It might be possible, however, to generate GIs without anyone knowing the group order, so maybe it's worth keeping the distinction between the two notions. So typically you would imagine having the group order is something gets generated when the group gets generated. So applications of trapdoor groups with infeasible inverses. So Vaikuntha Nathan, who's at MIT, has shown how to implement an identity-based encryption using TGII that has an efficient algorithm for sampling a random element together with its inverse. And I think that's interesting. It's not clear to me what other primitives we know about for implementing an identity-based encryption scheme. Not that we can implement this one, of course, but having sufficient conditions for implementing an identity-based encryption scheme, this may be, as far as I know, the only one outside of bilinear maps. Maybe somebody knows about others. And identity-based signatures, we know about identity-based encryption. Here's the construction, it's pretty simple. You've got a group with the trapdoor inverses, a couple of hash functions mapping between arbitrary strings and group elements both ways. So you take the ID of the person who you want to have identity-based encryption for, you hash that, so you're hashing from strings, which is the ID, to the group. That gives you the GID, the group element associated with that ID. The secret key associated with that is just the inverse of that element. So that can be computed by a system administrator who knows the trapdoor or something. This has a very familiar feel if you've looked at the other kinds of IB things based on bilinear maps. So there's a sysadmin or whatever that has the trapdoor information, computes the ID for that priority, gives it to them. And then there's a number of ways you can actually then use it. This would be a typical one where you take a message out that you want to encrypt. You pick a random R as a element of the group. You hash that into a string, which is XORed with the message, and then you also give that element of the group times the identity element, the GSIP ID for the that person with that ID. And then decrypt, since you've got the secret key, do the obvious inversion. Take the first part, undo the multiplication by GID, hash it, XOR that with the second part of the received message. And the sampling of pairs actually isn't needed for the operations itself, but it is needed in the reduction proof for as a notion of a chosen plaintext security in an identity-based system where the attacker can generate arbitrary numbers of identities and get secret keys associated with those, and then is asked to distinguish messages, the encryption of messages for another key. And that proof is needed for this. The assumption is needed, and the sampling of pairs is needed for that. So there's an application of trapdoor groups with infeasible inverses. Again, we know how to do these things other ways, bilinear maps, but if you had an implementation of trapdoor groups with infeasible inverses, it'd be another way of implementing this. So how to construct these things? Again, I don't know. That's my open problem for you. So by the end of the week, that's your homework assignment. Come up with one of these things. It can't be that hard, right? It feels that way. So the order of the group must clearly be hidden. The RSA group, as in star, seems like a good place to start. It's got a hidden order by the difficulty of factoring, but inverses seem easy to compute that group with the Euclid's algorithm. So that doesn't meet the definition. There is some work by Saxena and Saw where they try to at least approach the practical applications of this by having a trusted oracle or a server somewhere who can do some of the operations for them. It's cheating, although it's cheating in a practical sense, I guess. You just have this oracle that will compute the inverses for you. You can just give out representations that are encrypted. It's a trusted third party. So it's not really satisfactory in the sense that I'd like to see a solution to this problem. So that's the main open problem for this talk, is can you construct a representation of groups that has infeasible inverses or trapdoor construction of inverses? talk a little bit more about other related problems and application relations between this and other things, but that's the main point here. Yeah, question?
No, just it seems to me such a trusted oracle can do key agreement by sampling
Trust. It's always interesting. What do you consider cheating in this field, right? I mean, having a trusted third party certainly feels like cheating often. I mean, Dan Bonnet has a quote where he says, you know, using bilinear maps always feels like cheating too because it makes it so easy. I think the rules of the game ought to be pretty clear. You should be able to give me, pieces of Java code that implement, sampling from the group, implement composition within the group. Given all of that, I shouldn't be able to compute inverses. So related application area is transitive signatures. Sylvia McCullough and I looked at this. So it's a these are signature schemes on pairs of elements, A, B. So we can think of signing edges in a graph. So the signature on the edge A, B is the signature, kind of signatures we're talking about. And you can have either a directed graph or an undirected graph. So it's a transitive signature scheme if the signature on the edge AB and the signature on the edge BC, so there's trapdoor information that allows a single signer to produce those things. But then there's a public algorithm, this is the control flip here, so we've made that this new operation, a new operation and a new public operation. There's a public operation that allows you to combine those and come up with a signature on the transitive implication of that. So if you've got anybody has a signature on the edge AB, and anybody also has the same person has a signature on the edge BC, then they can come up with, using a public computation, a signature that's indistinguishable from what the original signer would have produced on the edge, the inferred edge AC. So it's indistinguishable from what, you just don't concatenate the two signatures together or something like that, but there's obvious things you want to rule out. And you can do this in either the directed case or the undirected case. So given the undirected case, so signature on edge one way is sufficient to give you the signature on the edge the other way. So you have the directed case picture like this. So if I sign this, and then I sign this, then you can come up with my signature on this edge. And maybe this application's for certificate chains and so on too. Some authority that says, Juan is a faculty member and then all faculty members have library privileges, then you can come up with a direct signature that says, does Juan have library privileges? So that would be the...
What if my signature depends on the last component? Is this a solution? If sigma of A, B is just sigma of B.
Then you can forge.
Yeah, there's an unforgeability thing to it. Just given the signature on A, B, you don't want a forgery of CB or something like that, right? It should be a sort of the usual properties of the signature scheme on the edges. So the definition says of security here says the adversary should not be able to come up with any signature for any edge other than those that he was either given directly initially or asked for, which he could infer by this deduction rule. So if you just had it depend on the last component, you could forge other edges coming into that vertex. Any question? Sure. This one?
Yeah, maybe I missed something, but is there any evidence that GII actually exists?
No.
So
wishful thinking. I mean, that's.
But if someone's.
That's the right attitude. Just prove that they don't exist, and maybe I.
But then all those metrics are just.
Yeah. No. I mean, that's the obvious caution. When you do research, you sort of hope that something exists. You spend all your time looking for a proof that it exists, and you ignore the simple argument that it can't exist whatsoever. And maybe I'm just blind in that sense. Yeah. So prove it doesn't exist. What? The evidence that they exist is that cryptography has continued to surprise me. And every time somebody polishes a set of requirements that seem totally contradictory, somebody comes up with a construction that seems to match all of them. The field has been amazing that way.
This doesn't seem contradictory.
It doesn't either, so it should be easier, right? Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's... It proving doesn't exist, then that saves people time to think about it anymore. Yes, sir.
Yeah, how hard would it be to compute E versus instance? If I give you one of these groups and also access to an inversion oracle, and this might be the case in some of the applications, it may be possible that using the oracle after making a few calls, then you are able to compute inverses on your own. Is this something you care about?
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, I mean, I think a satisfactory definition would say that after having seen a number of inverse pairs, I mean, either randomly sampled or having adversary, you know, sort of black box access to an oracle for inversion, that the adversary shouldn't be able to invert more randomly chosen elements.
But if it's a chosen, if you can, sample random elements A and an inverse, and then you can access the oracle after giving the challenge, then you could.
So, a random pair sample would just get A inverse, where A is chosen randomly, and then I get the inverse of A as well. So I don't get defeated A, I get experts inverse.
Right, but then you get another challenge B that you need to invert, but you can feed the oracle, you know, AB. If it's like a chosen, if you can feed the oracle, the inversion oracle with questions.
Right, this is like CCA or CCA2 kind of attacks.
CCA2, yeah,
kinds of attacks. You have to do the definitions and sort of to rule out sort of obvious attacks to make it interesting. Yes?
But there is this mathematical construction that any group read associates a group by just considering pairs of elements in the group read. I mean, AB stands for A minus B. And then with this definition, you can reconstruct the group, you can test for equality, and you introduce inversion, because you just say that minus A is just 1, comma A. Or 0.
So that's answering a different question, I think. That's the
But then it seems that to any group with impossible inverse, you associate a group where the inverse is possible, because you just have form for it, and then it's the same group, and it's just a different representation of the same group. So I mean, it means that you have to make it more precise what impossible inverse is, because to any group with impossible inverse, I can associate a group with possible inverse, and it is the same group.
But it depends on the presentation.
Yeah, but this is the way.
That's a good comment. So you're not solving the problem the way
I don't
phrase
think I solve the problem.
But it's interesting.
It should be made more accurate, because it's very...
So it's fine. The problem is to come up with a representation of the inverse. So when it's stopped, when it's...
It's a question intrinsic on the group. Probably depends on the...
Yeah, but basically I would say that if you have a group, then any representation for which you can test equality is a good representation of this group. So
the question is whether those representations of inverses in that expanded form as pairs would be useful in applications.
Yeah.
Right. So I mean, it might be the case that they don't fit, and therefore whatever security consequences that would follow from having inverses would be protected. Or maybe they do fit, and then you've got a problem. You'd have to look at the details. But that's a good, excellent comment. So how do these things fit in? I mean, if you've got, this is a chart out of Susan's thesis. And we've got a variety of things we know how to do. At the bottom, we've got one-way functions, standard digital signatures.
What is
standard digital signatures.
Standard.
That's the way she wrote it. And then we've got key agreement, and so we saw that groups with invisible inversion have a key agreement protocol, and I thought you know about these things too, right? So trapdoor permutations, oblivious transfer, public key encryption, bilinear maps, trapdoor discrete logs. So these problems seem to be sort of floating up. The unsolved open ones are up at the top here, and they seem to be floating up to the top. So maybe they're harder than some of the things we already know how to do. And so maybe these are sort of the interesting cherries of drawn in red here, you know, cherry picking, right? Next ones to be solved. So we can do undirected, but we don't know how to do directed transcript signatures. I didn't talk too much about that. So it's almost like your construction. You're constructing So it's starting a directed transfer signature scheme from a trapdoor group with infeasible inverses. So if you've got a way of computing inverses with a trapdoor, it seems like the obvious way of computing a signature on an edge AB is just A divided by B. And then you could take the same term. It should be unforgeable, something that is clearly composable. If you got A over B and then B over C, you multiply those together to get A over C, which is the signature on the edge. But actually, there's difficulties in proving that that actually is secure as well, if you get into the details. And David Molnar has been working hard at that recently. And I can tell you about all the difficulties with various obvious sort of proof approaches. So the arrow in this chart actually goes in this interesting direction rather than the other one. Probably they're equivalent. Chapter of pairings. So again, take this is again another example of this cloud of problems you can generate by doing control in different ways. So you can take a group with a bilinear map, and then just say, well, maybe I need to make that bilinear map computation controlled by having trapdoor information. What happens then? So I was teaching my students about bilinear maps in crypto class a couple of years ago, and I said, what are the applications? What, don't try to invent one of these, although if you do, that'd be great. But what are the applications for a bilinear map? Where you can control the bilinear pairing, I think, with a trapdoor somehow. So that was their homework assignment. They looked through all the applications and the data survey, all those zillion applications of bilinear maps, and were able to come up with nice ideas. And then more recently, Denton Galbraith have looked at the same question and actually trying to come up with proposals for systems where the bilinear map is controlled by a trapdoor. In terms of applications, for example, Denton Galbraith proposed ID schemes. So if you're the only one who can do a decision Diffie-Hellman, you can identify yourself by having the person, being the person with that trapdoor information, so you can tell GA, GB, GBAB from GA, GB, GBC. So you can identify yourself that way. And a lot of the signature schemes, the verification process uses the pairing, so you can make them designated verifier in some way so that the person who's supposed to verify has the trapdoor information. Constructing trapdoor pairings, so you can take standard notions of elliptic curves and run them over composite modules, so you depend on the difficulty of factoring. That's one of the proposals they make there. You sort of lose some of the advantages you have of elliptic curves, since you're now factoring based and the module gets quite large. Other approaches for disguising the structure of elliptic curves also seem to have problems. So this seems maybe doable. And the question maybe is, well, can you do it better? Well, the nice paper, I recommend the Denton Galbraith paper, which I think it's appearing in Ants this year. So to summarize, there's this grand research agenda, so have fun playing with that if you like. I think a couple of most interesting instances of that are trapdoor discrete log groups. So a system where you really can give out trapdoor information from computing the discrete log in a nice way. And the main one here is groups with infeasible inversion, either trapdoor or standard, under some reasonable assumptions. And maybe they just don't exist, so don't take my biases as the right one. Maybe just prove that they can't exist under some, or maybe they're trivial for some other reason, that they're just some other way of thinking about this. Making better trapdoor pairings where the efficiency is better, and there's also this thing relating trapdoor groups with infeasible inversion to directed transitive signature schemes, which I think is a cute problem too. But the main one is this, so that's my proposal for this workshop here, and if somebody is able to knock that one off, I think my trip out here will be worth it, then that'd be great. So thanks for your attention.